The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Preparing the Ruins, the 2015 Annual Conference Recordings, copyright 2015. If you have purchased this recording, you may make additional copies for use by your school. You may not sell copies of the recording, nor post it on the internet. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at www.accsedu.org.
They told me no one was going to introduce me, so you can decide whether I'm Athens or Jerusalem during the course of this talk. Mr. Jerusalem couldn't make it. I fear that I represent Mr. Athens today. The good news about the time we live in is that if President Roosevelt could stand in front of a group of progressives and say, "We stand at Armageddon and we battle for the Lord," while those progressives left singing "Onward Christian Soldiers," I'd like to suggest to you that when Hillary Clinton gets the nomination, the Democratic Party will not leave singing "Onward Christian Soldiers." But if they did, the New York Times would have a meltdown worrying about a coming theocracy. The good news about the age in which we live is that we stand after Armageddon. And because we believe in the providence of God, we do not battle for the Lord, but we trust that when the armies have arisen against God's Israel, that the battle will be the Lord's, and we will be on the Lord's side. It is not your job or my job as teachers of young adults to win a culture war that is already lost. It is our job to renew what can be saved, to do our jobs, and to wait now for the coming revival of faith and reason. Because as surely as we stand here today, as soon as things look utterly lost, the Church of Jesus Christ wins. And as soon as we appear to be winning, we become corrupted by personal peace and affluence and lose. As a member of a church whose leadership is in captivity in Syria and whose members are being beheaded today, I'd like to urge you that though things can get worse, they probably will not. And that the United States is fortunate in that our elites have decided not to embrace a religion like Islam. Instead, they've become decadent like Las Vegas. And if I had to choose who was going to ruin us, I'd rather be ruined by people who are probably too stoned in the morning to harm me than people who want to chop off my head. If I had to choose between living next to Tehran or atheistically next to North Korea or next to Las Vegas, I'd pick Las Vegas. But at the very moment when a certain kind of sin seems absolutely likely to triumph, now's the time to buy. Everyone should go start a Christian school. Because our day is coming, and it's coming within the next decade. I no longer have to stand in front of groups of people and urge them that America faces a moment of absolute decision. Have you noticed that? No longer do you go to church and people say, "Wow, don't do anything too crazy. It's going to be okay if we only elect a better president. Or if we only stop annoying people." I want to suggest to you, and I can tell you this as someone who blogs in the secular area, that eventually just saying Christian truth got me gently removed from the Washington Post. And in private, causes very prominent atheists to say that people with my opinions legally should not be given a forum to spread hate any place in the United States. Now, I'm the kind of person in a group like this that's probably about as liberal as you're willing to listen to. So when it gets to the point that my Eisenhower Republicanism has become too conservative, too Christian for the elites of our culture, I no longer have to persuade people that we are not cool. Here's an idea. If you're in a school that ever worries about being cool, stop. Anybody who worries about being cool isn't. By nature. Cool people never worry about being cool. They simply are. But here's the best news of all. In the ruins in which we stand. There used to be a time when I'd turn on public television, and after they showed me a film, something like Life of the Kumquat. Life of the Kumquat. And kind of go to sleep. Then if you were lucky, you got Monty Python. But the biggest disappointment in my life was going to Britain and discovering that British TV is no better than American TV. I had just watched the best of British TV, like All Creatures Great and Small, my whole life. So British TV was just degenerate when I got there. Or American. It's very sad. But it used to be that when I watched public television, I would get the great cultural artifacts of Western civilization, not counting Lawrence Welk, which for some reason in our region they showed us on public television. We also got classical music, Shakespeare, theater. We got the great texts explained and discussed. If it was a conservative, you got someone like William F. Buckley on Firing Line. But even the left engaged in interesting and intellectually stimulating conversations. I will confess to having listened more to NPR as a young adult than to any other station, because even the left at that time was dominated by a desire to preserve Athens. And the criticism of Christianity that was abroad in the university of my young adulthood was that we were anti-intellectual, that we despised things like Shakespeare, and that we could not be trusted with Western cultural artifacts. But I am now standing in a room full of teachers committed to teaching the best of Western civilization, and almost for sure, you are the only people in your city or town so dedicated. Once again, as it was in the days of Byzantium or Rome, it is only the Christians that still read Aristotle and try to understand him. Oddly enough, it's probably only the Christian school that actually reads Darwin and tries to follow his arguments, even if we come to the conclusion, as I have, that I am not persuaded by them. In short, the situation is no longer what it was in my childhood. As always happens, intellectuals who cut themselves off from the lordship of Jesus Christ have now ceased to be truly intellectual at all. They have become tyrants, mental bullies, who instead of arguing for their case, will insert that most dangerous of academic words, the word clearly. If you listen to an intellectual and they say clearly, whatever is about to come isn't. Clearly a man is a woman. Clearly white people are black people. Clearly, I've looked into Vlad Putin's soul and he has one. The minute something is clear, In academic circles, it almost surely isn't. So here's the good news. When I was a little boy, Jerusalem was still well inhabited. Lots of people lived there. But they kind of took it for granted, and whether they were actually citizens of that city of God to come, they had kind of a feeling that they should be. As my dad told me when I was a little boy, as we walked home from church in the 1970s, he said this, "John Mark, when I grew up, the most pressing need in evangelism," he was a pastor, "was to explain to my friends that they weren't actually Christians." And so you had tracts that said things like, "Being born in America no more makes you a Christian than being born in a garage makes you a car." But of course, nowadays, people feel insulted, or at least our intellectual elites, if you claimed they were Christians. Remind yourself that in the 1950s, when William F. Buckley wrote God and Man at Yale, where he had the nerve to claim that Yale was no longer a Christian or Christian-friendly university, the president of Yale was so offended that he took to the New York Times to thunder that the Roman Catholic Buckley had simply misunderstood the nature of Christianity and that Yale was too a Christian university. Here's a suggestion. If your local school, if you're in Idaho, write a letter to the editor claiming that the University of Idaho is a Christian university. And you're most likely to get a thundering letter from the president demonstrating how insulting and wrong you are. So Jerusalem, we know, has been abandoned and lost its popularity, at least with those people who control our educational system. But here is odd news. Athens is equally abandoned. Because the rigor of logic and the rigor of thought places you too close to the second person of the Trinity. And so whenever people become hostile to Christianity, they become hostile to logic. Because it is the Logos of God that was made flesh and dwelt among us. And people who deny the lordship of Jesus Christ will ultimately deny the sufficiency of reason and envelop themselves in a hyper-emotionalism guarded by state power. They will persecute because only state power can any more undergird their righteousness. And any attempt on your part to use reason will be called, if you're me, mansplaining, or the product of privilege. And so we no longer have to listen to your arguments because the genetic fallacy is the fallacy of our age. Remind yourself, what is the genetic fallacy? That what matters is not the truth of the claim, or the persuasiveness of the argument, but where the argument came from. When I was a young adult getting a PhD in analytic philosophy, one of the first things they would tell you is that if somebody like Hegel had actually been, and we weren't as sure now as then as we are now, had been tainted by bad ideas like National Socialism, horrible evil, we have to be careful not to dismiss what he said out of hand, because this was an example of the genetic fallacy. We do, after all, drive on the Autobahn. And Volkswagen wasn't a worse car because Hitler was involved in its creation. Or so my atheistic logic teachers taught me. But the genetic fallacy is now enshrined as public policies in higher education across the United States, where the measure of the worth of an argument is the person who made it or the sincerity of the claim. And Athens, the Athens of Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, cannot survive in a world where the judgment is not on the truth, goodness, or beauty of the argument, but on the truth, goodness, and beauty of the person making the claim. Science cannot survive. Recently, a Nobel Prize winner made an offhand remark that was stupid and offensive and gross. Was he joking? Some of his women colleagues say, yes, he's actually a good person, fair to women, helping their careers. But whatever the truth of what this Nobel Prize winning scientist said, and nothing he said was true, his work and his ability to contribute to the academy are now over because he is now tainted and all his work is tainted and anything else he would do would be tainted with his foolish views. Now, it's hard to use this as an example because the man was so offensive. But his science was no less scientific. Even if his views were as offensive as the ones he seemingly expressed and then apologized for. But an apology is no longer good enough because Athens has been sacked. Science cannot survive in a world where what gets included in the review of your work are your beliefs, so that a scientist in California with no young earth creationist views finds soft tissue, apparently, in a dinosaur fossil, publishes his work in a peer-reviewed journal, drawing no conclusions in the journal article. And then in his private or evangelistic or church life, draws the conclusion that this finding supports his young earth creationist views, for which he is terminated. The quality of the man's science no longer counts more than the evil of the view that produced it. Should science, after all, care that one of the simulation models to do plate tectonics was developed by a young earth creationist on the side to help him model flood geology? Up to this point in history, no, they have not cared. They've used the tool because Athens has always said it doesn't matter if we agree with the source of the tool. What we care about is the value of the product. What I'm saying to you is, unlike the National Public Radio or the PBS of my youth, the intellectual class has now been seized by the genetic fallacy, and so that what counts more than the content of your argument is the political correctness of your character. And in fact, if you vote right, your behavior in private counts less, your abuse of women counts less than your voting record. In other words, the content of your character no longer counts because truth, goodness, and beauty have been replaced by ideology. Now, at this moment, we could all grow smug, congratulate ourselves for missing this, unless we note that in some Christian schools over the last 20 years, what is counted in the Christian textbooks or in the delivery of education has not been goodness, truth, and beauty. Have you looked at Christian textbooks? But that the source came from the proper ideological place. I know of Christian schools that will not read pagan literature because it comes from pagan sources, predating the coming of Christ often by 400 or 500 years. But then foolishly end up reading Herman Melville. Apparently, hating Jesus is better than not knowing about him. But if I point out this hypocrisy to the schools, they remove Melville. They don't add Homer. Because what matters to those schools following the genetic fallacy is not the content of the text, which is always complex unless we're talking about the inerrant, inspired Word of God. And even then, our interpretations are mixed. No book is so good, true, and beautiful other than the Bible that it does not contain some ugliness, falsehood, and evil. No book is so bad that it isn't redeemable. Some books just aren't worth the effort or beneficial for me to redeem. It is, after all, the job of a Christian to be an ambassador and a reconciler in this world so that the crooked things, including my own soul, can be, by the grace and providence of God, be made straight and the rough places plain. For too long, Christians have justified ineptitude in education because our hearts are right. Probably the most guilty feature of this kind of education has been the intellectual fraud of online education in Christian circles, where certain students are viewed as cash cows to pay for the education of other students. Teachers, the minute you work in an organization where you're told that some students don't need the kind of education you're offering because they're the children of farmers, I'll tell you this. You're not the elitist. They are the bigots. And online education no more removes the need for discipleship than on-site education. But when we have online programs for homeschoolers and for Christian colleges where the teacher ratio is actually greater than 600-1, let me ask you this question. Would you send your students, or would you in your Christian school simply make a classroom this size and put 600 students in it and call it a good education? What is miraculous about being online that allows me to mentor or disciple more people than Jesus thought he could handle, and he lost one? Our good intentions and our Christian worldview do not justify creating an elitist system of education where some people simply get credentialed, get union cards in a high school or a college diploma so that they can be workers for the omnipotent state, while some select elite few are given an education that allows them to move into leadership. And I am looking at a group of teachers who are creating the next generation's leadership because you refuse to compromise. As a little boy in West Virginia, people would come from Christian colleges to help us because we were deprived. Now, we were deprived. But what they would come and help us do is build houses and dig ditches. Now, if there's one thing I'm clear we knew how to do in West Virginia, it was build houses and dig ditches. And they were no good at it. Imagine a group of New York, upstate New York, Christian college students coming down to West Virginia and digging ditches. Now, we let them do it. Lordy. But I remember men standing on fences and shaking their heads and saying, "What's wrong with those boys?" Get a pinch of Union Tobacco spit right under the Do Not Expectorate sign in downtown Clendenin. They weren't expectorating, just spitting. You see, what everyone decided in their infinite wisdom was what we did not need was Shakespeare or opera. And what they did not need was to listen to the bluegrass and other art forms that we were creating in churches across the state. Our poverty was the result of our lack of material possessions, not in our lack of world-class education. And so they brought us material possessions and then wrote learned studies about us as if we were rats in test tubes. I was a precocious little kid. I'm the kind of kid you didn't want to have in class. My dad, who was the principal of the Christian school I attended, once I became the director of the Torrey Honors Institute at Biola, sent me a note that a teacher had sent him as principal. And it said, we don't know what to do about John Mark. He sits in the back of the room reading Lord of the Rings, writing poetry, and translating jokes into bad Spanish. My dad wrote on the bottom of this note, "Now you get paid to do all those things. Well done." He felt justified in his education. Now, as a precocious little kid, and I remember picking up the denominational magazine, because there was an article written by a person who had been my friend the previous summer. And there I saw myself described as a sociologically deprived young adult that they had spent the summer uplifting. I just thought we were friends. I at first didn't know if I should get a t-shirt that said, "I am sociologically deprived." I wasn't sure what it meant. I was kind of proud of it. I know this, by the time we moved to upstate New York to go to school and they put me in a class for learning disabled students, because I had been, as they said to my dad, culturally deprived, I knew enough to know that this wasn't a good thing. And so I drilled my Southern accent out of my head, unfortunately, by listening to what I discovered later was Canadian radio. Which is why I now have an accent somewhere between a West Virginian sounding like a Canadian crossed with a Swede who's slightly inebriated. It's just, my students can never figure out where I'm coming from. What's the point of all of this? Too much of Christian education assumes that the students in front of us do not need the treasures of Athens, because what we're providing them is a union card to live quiet, passive, middle-class lives in a roughly Christian America. But in the America that we face today, after Armageddon, we must teach our young adults to lead by giving them all the glories of Athens, because in the ruin that we live in now, we do not know what student will pass forward the heritage of Athens and Jerusalem, and we cannot assume that we can guess. We cannot be elitist or snobbish enough to believe that some of our students deserve a second-rate education and others of our students deserve education for leadership. We cannot make West Virginia the state for the hewers of wood and New York the state where our leadership will come from. Because I'll tell you this, if the United States faces imminent peril and they do have to call up a draft, it will no longer be Yale types like George H.W. Bush who will lie their way into the Pacific War, too young to fight. It won't be Harvard or Berkeley that empty themselves to provide the people to keep us safe and to preserve what liberty we have left. It will be young men and women from states like West Virginia. And if you look to them to preserve the civilian virtues, and their only education came from a professional military, then I stand on the other side of history to tell you that we will produce a military hostile and foreign to civilian values, and the Republic cannot long endure such a state. If our officer class gets their first education from an army now disconnected from broad social values, we know what will happen. Americans do not have a particular immunity to tyranny or military dictatorship. We don't have particular immunity to decadence. And so your school, you as a teacher, are all that remains of Athens and the preservation of that culture. We cannot deny reality as Christians. But our culture now denies most of reality by denying the existence of God and His relevance to what's happening in the world. But now I'll take the meddling, as they say in West Virginia. The word beauty appears in Scripture as often as any other word, and when we're reminded that the Greek word for goodness can also be translated beauty, and that the Greek of the New Testament assumes that in truth there is beauty, to paraphrase a better speaker and writer than I am, then we are reminded that there is a Christian Jewish value to beauty for its own sake. If you get to heaven and you don't like the way the New Jerusalem looks, that's why there's hell. I suspect the devil wants to do interior design in the New Jerusalem. If you don't like pearly gates, don't go. They're going to be there, whatever that symbol means. The law of the Lord is not just true. What is it? Beautiful. If you think it's harsh and ugly, you're wrong. As wrong, though in a different way, as if you believe 2 plus 2 equaled 5. If you think Miley Cyrus creates beautiful music, you're wrong. Just as surely as if you don't understand that the David is a sublime and beautiful work of art, whatever its defects philosophically. Beauty must be inculcated in our Christian higher education for its own sake. But what about the poor, you say to me? I'm from about the poorest state in the Union. West Virginia exists so Mississippi can feel better about itself. And someone came, the Rockefellers or others are always coming to represent us, and in our social inferiority, we both are proud of ourselves and depressed about ourselves simultaneously. We always elect them to the Senate and then mock them in private because they give us free food. They came down and they said, look at this beautiful state capitol modeled on the national capitol next to the Kanawha River. It's gilded in gold. We're a poor state. We can't afford that. And so they stripped all the gold off and painted it gray. Now I'll just tell you this. They never gave my granddaddy, they never gave Papa 1 cent back on his state taxes. State taxes went up and the state capitol was uglier. And the Rockefellers didn't go home to uglier houses. They still live surrounded by beauty that they could afford. But they took the public display of beauty and they stripped it to give to the poor. And somehow the poor, that's us, never get it. Because here's a general rule of thumb when you do biblical exegesis. Just as in ethics, it doesn't prove, this would be the genetic fallacy. Let's look at the genetic fallacy for a minute. The fact that Hitler agrees with you doesn't prove you're wrong, but should disturb you. The fact that the only person in the Bible that makes your argument is Judas Iscariot is not good news. If you have a young adult and you ask them their favorite disciple and they say Judas Iscariot, worry. That's not a great choice. Can we discuss this? This is not an example of a genetic fallacy. This is prudence. And it was Judas who said, when a woman engaged in performance art, Jesus was not dead, but she anointed his feet with expensive oil. It was Judas who said, can't we take this and sell it and give to the poor? And all the disciples agreed. Now, why did Judas say that? For the same reason West Virginia politicians took the gilding off the dome. They wanted to steal the money. In West Virginia, we often have multiple governors in prison at the same time. We don't have to pension our governors. The state of West Virginia does that for us. It's called the prison system. They eat and grow fat. No, here's the truth of it. Our Christian schools should be the most beautiful buildings on the planet. And it is the government schools that have designed schools that are easy to maintain and clean, but ugly. It is Christians in an infinitely poorer age who took an Oxford and made it Oxford, with buildings so beautiful and services so divinely moving that Richard Dawkins will not tear them down. If the last Christian were to die at Oxford, the gospel of Jesus Christ would still be preached in glass and stone to the coming generation, because what Christians created was so beautiful that even the pagans will not destroy it. Though if ISIS gets there, they surely will. Because ISIS, to their credit, understands that beauty is one of the most powerful witnesses to the truth of a thing. Is your Christian school classroom like an Oxford reading room, a room where people want to stay when class is over? Or have you created a pragmatic, utilitarian space that no one would go to unless they were forced to by the state? Do our values get reflected in our architecture? Or have we all become John Stuart Mill, where the values of pragmatism are reflected in our architecture? Do your children sit in comfortable chairs, or do they sit in chairs that a committee decided you could afford? Are your students surrounded by beautiful artwork? I didn't say expensive artwork. Hang a West Virginia quilt on the wall. My great-granddaddy built a church with his own hands, out of hard wood and hand tools. And the next generation was ashamed of how country it looked and went down to the Kmart and bought a whole bunch of ugly for money and covered up the hardwood with blue nylon carpet and installed fake stained glass in the replacement of the Depression-era glass that they had put in. And they took the quilts off the beds that had been made by hand by Civil War veterans and threw them in the garbage to buy polyester blankets made by Chinese slave labor. Beauty is often cheap, ugly, costly. Remember, it's the Church of Jesus Christ that went in Egypt and exiled to the garbage dumps of Egypt, carved out of the stone of Egypt in our lifetimes, cathedrals so beautiful that now tourists come to visit them. Does your school reflect your values for all the students? Second, we cannot deny reality, so we must speak the truth, even if it comes from Athens and not from Jerusalem. And this means we will live in a constant tension. People are always asking me to clarify what I have to say. Here's some really bad news. Who's right, the Republicans or the Democrats? I don't know. I'm really sure of this. My liberal friends are always telling me God's not a Republican, and I think they're exactly right. He's clearly a monarchist. In one way, in this life, nobody's our ally, including us. The line between good and evil doesn't lie between political parties. It runs, as Solzhenitsyn would point out to you, and Dostoevsky wrote whole novels demonstrating, right down your heart. Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner. So that speaking the truth in this age is either personally difficult for the school, or the truth is not being spoken. If the only truth we're willing to speak is to the other that probably needs to hear the truth we're speaking, but none of it bites on our own school, then we are probably not preaching the full gospel of Jesus Christ. Because if there's one thing I'm sure of, it is that we are totally depraved. And so goodness must also be foundational in our schools. It is not Christians who judge an argument by the person who makes it. We accept the argument and judge the person. I want to say this as clearly as I can. It is a mark of the fall of the West that the elites of our age now will not judge persons, but judge arguments. They have it exactly wrong. We do, after all, want our students to come into a living and vibrant confrontation with Jesus Christ. We do not want to educate clever children, but godly children. We cannot forget Jerusalem while promoting Athens. Now, how do we keep that balance? I'm always asked that. And just like the balance between left and right, up and down, I don't know. My grandfather used to describe a certain person as so holy, quote unquote, so straight they leaned a little. Have you ever met a person so straight they leaned a little? It's hard to argue with that person. But I'll tell you this. 20 years ago, I'm on tape saying that certain groups were bound to be cultic and abusive because they were always upping the holiness ante on everybody else. How do we reconcile ourselves to this degenerate age? How much TV or any TV or what TV, what film or what? You know what Paul would say? All things are lawful, but not all things are beneficial. I believe in objective morality. I hope you've gotten that by now. How much sin is okay? No sin is okay. What things are beneficial, however, is utterly subjective. It is the difference between the objectivity of beauty and the subjectivity of modesty. Look at your school's dress code, however. Does it inculcate a desire to dress beautifully, or does it inculcate a subjective cultural value of what is modest? Do you spend all your time judging others based on what is beneficial to you, using the weaker brother principle as a passive-aggressive tool to control other people? Have you ever met one of those weaker brothers? Sister, you're stumbling me. Which takes their lust and puts it as your problem. You could wear a burqa, trust me, and men would lust. My friends who are monastics say that if you think going to a monastery, all men, removes your desire, it does nothing of the sort. It concentrates it. So the curve of a piano leg can cause you to stumble. When the Victorians got to the point where they wouldn't put a book by Jane Austen next to a book by a male author, lest they be caused to sin or think naughty thoughts, you will realize that you cannot grow so subjectively pure that you can avoid the objectivity of sin. Let's make the subjective qualities in our school subjective to the individuals and seek the objective goodness, truth, and beauty of the gospel. And yet our Christian colleges have failed even worse at this. As we have surrendered again and again the objective truths of the inerrant, inspired Word of God to embrace the subjective realities of the intellectual elites of our time. when we care more about what the University of Chicago or UCLA or Rice think of us than we care about what Almighty God think of us, then we no longer deserve to exist. And so the standards of our age, whether they come from the government or the secular establishment, can no longer be the standards because they are too low. If you have the right cant, if you have the right jargon, they will not judge you. They will let you do your fun little Christian thing over in a side corner, sitting on the back of secularism's bus. But instead, if we proclaim the Lordship of Jesus Christ and what is good, true, and beautiful, and refuse to accept the subjective standards of what is excellent in education from state-controlled accreditation agencies that only exist to move state money around to wards of the state, then we will matter. I'd like to get to the point where a Christian school I'm involved in causes people to either consider whether they should kill us or convert, not whether they should pat us on the head and tell us we can go on being irrelevant in the back channels. I'm told now that perhaps the omnipotent state will allow me to speak the truth about men and women and sexuality based on religious freedom. I do not want to be permitted to do a thing I have a God-given right to do, speak the truth and live virtuously, based on the sufferance of Caesar. I'll take it and use it to establish the Lordship of Jesus Christ and the truth that all men and women are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with rights the government didn't give us, so the government cannot justify or take away, and that among these are the right to life, liberty, and that means the right to do good, not the right to do evil. There is no right to vice for any human being. And I will not accept on sufferance from the state, as if the state gave me a thing that God gave me, the right that only came from God. Is Jesus Lord, brothers and sisters? Is He? What's He Lord of? Is Satan alive and well on planet Earth? No, Satan is crushed and defeated. His head is crushed. If you want to join a movement that takes the sign of the cross and takes it up as if it's therapy, some therapeutic aspirin, find a new faith. We are the faith of the cross, which says my desires will be crucified. My sins will be crucified. My passions will be crucified so that I can become more truly myself, created in the image of God. I will take up my cross. And in the words of Constantine, in this sign, I will conquer. Because the God of the cross, the God who said, "It is finished," did not remain on the cross, and He did not remain in the tomb. And my symbol is not an empty tomb, but a throne on which King Jesus sits, and on which a heavenly kingdom will come, and we will rule and reign on the earth with Jesus. And if my school is not a foretaste of paradise, if you have a board or an administration that governs by fear or terror, to the extent that we do not govern as a community of love under the rule of King Jesus, where the soul liberty of each person is protected, where the beauty of each human being is acknowledged, when our schools are merely a reflection of the tyrannical status power of the age with a Christian veneer, then we have ceased to be Christian. I had a relative at Yorktown. And at Yorktown, the saying came that I would repeat to you, no king, but King Jesus. And that includes no petty potentate in my local Christian school. If you're a Catholic, pardon me, but I'm not. If I had to pick a pope, I'd probably pick the one in Rome. They're good at it, having done it for a long time. What I will not do is pick a petty self-appointed pope in a local Christian institution who has confused the anointing of God and the charism of God with the right to abuse faculty. Instead, our Christian schools must be a place that people want to work. Because there, every student, every faculty member, every janitor is considered a soul created in the image of God and is equally part of the formation and decision making. We should not have congregational churches and end up with schools that are run by petty tyrants. Other than that, I will try to say nothing controversial to you and say this. With homeschool mothers, I mentioned homeschool dads, but we are in general irrelevant. With homeschool mothers, I believe that I am looking in this room of classical Christian teachers at the hope of the West. To which I said to your principals yesterday, that means the West has fallen. If we're the hope of the West, good night, nurse. It used to be King Arthur and Galahad, and now it's us. It used to be Constantine seeing a sign of a cross, and in this side conquer. And now it's a bunch of middle-aged people worried about whether they can teach Latin to 12-year-olds. Stephen Austin built an empire in a wilderness. Sam Houston sobered up long enough to defeat an empire, come to faith in Christ, see his sins washed away in a muddy Texas river, and stand firm for union and liberty for all people. And we live in the most affluent country at the other end of what the greatest generation have given us. And we realize that we have lost, that our generation, the generation of the baby boomers and Generation X, have washed away all that my grandparents gave us. And we whine and complain. Brothers and sisters, if Austin and Houston could create Texas out of the wilderness that they found, we can create something awesome in our Christian schools with much more wealth, much more education, much more prosperity, and the Lordship of Jesus Christ backing us. We have not lost. We are about to win. And that's why I and a group of people have doubled down. No more. Seeking Caesar's power. But instead, despite the fact that I've been lucky enough to work at some of the greatest Christian institutions that are awesome, send your kids to Biola or HBU, they'll get a great education. But instead of spending the last 15 years, I'm 52 at the end of this month, doubling down on what has been, making more old wine to put in old wineskins, I'll say to you that the new day that has come, the new ability to bring Athens and Jerusalem together requires a more radical solution. So I and a group of colleagues have stepped back. to start a new college, a new school, not one that will become large and imperial and dominate your schools, but one that can join with you and serve from pre-K through college. Everything that's being done as we join our resources together to form something new and glorious on the face of the earth, something good and true and beautiful in education, something that has both the sacrifice of the cross and the conquest of the cross, something that acknowledges the gift of suffering that is Christianity and the gift of the triumph of Jesus Christ. What I would ask is that today you lift up your heads for one moment. I taught 7th grade social studies. I know that all this sounds glorious, and all I was trying to do was get them to remember that the Erie Canal went from Albany to Buffalo. And even with a song, they couldn't remember it. I know that this sounds foolish. But I know. If we go to work every day, I was told recently that the preschool curriculum for a particular age is to teach kids to sit up. I feel qualified to teach kids to sit up. They seem to do it even if I don't teach them well. If we go to work to do what seems like the trivial tasks with the big idea in mind that we are preserving Western civilization, then like those monks that copied the documents that now you use to teach your students, none of whose names are remembered except by God, our trivial tasks will become great tasks. Our small things will become great things. I will not be Aquinas. But I may be the person who teaches Albert, who teaches Thomas. Will you join us? Will you stand up and for one moment shake off the fear of this present age, which thinks you're foolish and stupid and of no account, and say this: King Jesus knows my name. King Jesus governs my school. King Jesus is coming to rule and reign on the earth, and I will be his vice regent in this age, and our school will be an outpost of a new Rome, a new city, a new Jerusalem, against the shadow of that hideous strength. Thank you, and God bless your work.